Welcome to In Context. My name is Ken McDermott-Rowe. This is W.P. Ken's live call-in public affairs program. I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Cantavero.
Hi, everybody. Good to be back.
And behind the boards doing double duty is our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott-Rowe.
Afternoon.
We have a really interesting show for you today on psychiatric drugs. A couple announcements first. I just want to remind everyone that we're on Mondays between noon and 1 p.m. live, and we take your calls every Monday except the first Monday of the month. And we're also now on YouTube, right, Gus?
That's right. We have a YouTube channel. You can find that by searching the channel In Context Report on YouTube, and we have a variety of videos up there. We do a new one every week, and we're kind of experimenting with the formats. We may actually be doing a couple of short segments every week, just 5-6 minute videos, just quick hitters, tackling a topic, showing some sources. They're really cool videos where we bring up the articles, show where we get the information, and try to link people to where they can do some more research themselves. So search us out there, subscribe to the channel, and share the videos.
And our website is incontextreport.com, where we have blog and announcements and
archives.
That's
right. You can find us on Facebook as well, facebook.com/incontext.
So we're coming at you from every direction.
In Context Report.
And one sad announcement. On Friday, a longtime volunteer and dear friend of ours, J.F. Friedrichs, passed on. He was had a program here under the name of NASMO here for many years. He was a good and a kind person, and he'll be missed very much by everybody here in the WPCAN family. Now, today's show, we're going to ask the question, psychiatric drugs, do they do more harm than good? And we're very fortunate to have as our guest Dr. Peter Bregan, who is a practicing psychiatrist and an expert on clinical, let me get this right, psychopharmacology. And Dr. Bregan has testified as an expert witness in both civil and criminal cases involving psychiatric drugs. He's the author of more than 20 books, including Toxic Psychiatry, Talking Back to Prozac, and Medication Madness. Dr. Bregan, are you with us?
I am. Glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for joining
us.
Yes,
thank you very much.
This is such an important subject.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could give us the scope of the situation by telling us about how widespread is the use of drugs like Prozac and Ritalin to treat conditions like depression and ADHD, and why should people be concerned about their use?
Well, the figures are astounding. One study has shown that 20% of women right now are taking antidepressants. It's an incredible number, but not
20% of women?
Women.
What, 20%, though?
Yes.
Wow.
20% at any time, right now.
So you're talking tens of millions of American women.
Oh, yes. And then if we look at overall, a recent study has shown that 20% of Americans consider that they've had a major mental illness in the past year, which means that they've been put on probably multiple psychiatric drugs. We have studies showing that nearly 10% of our boys have been especially our older boys, have been diagnosed with ADHD. And that's just ADHD. There's a huge push now to diagnose children with bipolar disorder. We're talking about tens of millions of Americans being given these drugs. You know, if you go back to just the children's issue, when I was in my training, you wouldn't find that percentage of children being drugged in a children's mental hospital. Mm. Most of them be getting therapy and family interventions and other caring approaches. So we've really made our society into a kind of mental health treatment facility where people commonly talk about what disease they have and what drug they're taking. And these are very dangerous agents.
One of the concepts that you talk about in your book is the spellbinding effect of these drugs. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, if you think of the well-known phenomenon of somebody who's drinking alcohol, they may think they're being the life of the party when they're actually driving people away from them, maybe even out of the party.
Right.
Or if you, there used to be ads that friends don't let drunk friends drive. If you've ever tried to stop a friend from driving who's drunk, they'll tell you they can drive better than ever and better than you, and what are you going to do about it, and don't perceive what they're doing. Again, with the analogy to alcohol, there are many people, especially men, who become very violent and destructive to their families
mm-hmm.
when they're drinking. But if they go to AA, they get themselves cleaned up, they become sober, they don't do that anymore. Now, all psychoactive substances produce effects like that. If you've been at a party where somebody's smoking dope and you're not, the jokes are just not that funny and the stuff being said is not that profound.
Mm-hmm.
And the cookies ain't that great. So all drugs obscure from us their adverse effects.
So putting it in layman's terms, it sets the bar much lower for how funny a joke is, in other words.
Yeah, well, it sets the judgment bar in general much lower. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's an interesting way to think of it. That's the judgment bar much lower. And it sets the impulse control bar much lower.
Mm-hmm.
It reduces us to a lower state of self-appreciation, judgment, self-control.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that concept. I'd never thought of it that way.
That's why I'm on the air.
There you go. This effect can be very mild in that the person is just not quite as sharp as they used to be but doesn't appreciate it. Or it can go all the way to mania.
Mm-hmm.
And you have situations in which individuals get very high on these drugs and do horrible and destructive things that
right.
they think are really powerful and wonderful things. Mm-hmm. Rob banks, shoot people, and stuff like that.
Or in the extreme case, which you know, we want to get to, when people have a psychotic break when they're on an antidepressant and they snap and think that they need to either kill themselves or kill somebody else. How does someone go from being depressed where they withdraw from society, which is what happens when I get depressed or when I know people who are depressed, they withdraw. But then they go on a medication that causes them to just one day snap and go nuts. Now all of a sudden they're psychotic. How does that transition happen?
One of the mechanisms of these drugs, and by the way, all psychoactive substances, all psychiatric drugs
mm-hmm.
cause spellbinding.
Okay.
And I just designate the medications as medication spellbinding. Well, there are many mechanisms and clinical manifestations of this phenomena of people getting crazier and crazier on psychiatric drugs. But a classic one was the story of the young man in Canada. You can find it on my webpage on Bregin.com, BREGGIN.com,
mm-hmm.
Where I testified in court. In Canada, and the judge came to totally agree with what I said. It was a first case that a judge, rather than a jury, had actually come to a conclusion that Prozac induced a murder. And this was a boy who was 17 at the time, and he felt a little depressed. He told his parents he was feeling depressed. He'd been using drugs in the past, and he was trying not to use them anymore. And mom took him to the pediatrician. The pediatrician put him on Prozac.
Mm-hmm.
Over the coming summer, he got crazier and crazier. He got more agitated, more anxious. He started talking grandiosely about things. He was
mm-hmm.
very irritable. He ran away from home.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this is an amphetamine-like effect. It's a cocaine-like effect that the antidepressants can have. So you go from having what will be clinically called a depression to an agitated depression, which is a very dangerous state to get into, where now you're excited, you're overstimulated, but you're still not feeling good. In this case, though, the boy really didn't even have a major depressive disorder by DSM diagnosis. He just was feeling a little down, like adolescents get.
Right.
But the drug just drove him into this highly energized, out-of-control, amphetamine-like state. Well, his mother brought him back. The pediatrician, and he also attempted suicide, which he'd never done before early
mm-hmm.
on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the pediatrician realized something was wrong, when after he started the boy on the drug, within a few days, he got suicidal. The pediatrician said, well, maybe this is the drug, because there are warnings in Canada, just like in the U.S., that these drugs will cause suicidality.
Right.
And in Canada, there's a warning that they'll cause violence,
mm-hmm.
which we don't specifically have in the U.S.
Right. So,
and you mentioned these adverse effects take place with routine doses.
Oh, totally routine doses, yes. Even quote low doses. People respond very differently to the drugs at different times, and they start with the first dose. They can happen, and they tend to be worst in the early weeks before the brain begins to fight back and compensate, and you get a kind of an imbalance, you know, the drug fighting the brain, and that goes on. But it's in the initial. It's like the first time a person has a drink or the first time a person smokes cigarettes. You get a more profound effect because the brain's not used to it. It hasn't developed compensatory mechanisms.
Yeah, I was amazed in the cases in your book, Medication Madness.
Let me just finish this story. Okay. I've been a little presenting it in a little bit of a garbled fashion. I apologize to your audience for that. So the parents took him to the psychiatrist now at the suggestion of the pediatrician. And the psychiatrist paid no attention to the warnings from the pediatrician, paid no attention to the warnings from the mom. And finally, when the parent brought her son in very distressed after about 30 days or so on the drug, they increased the dose.
Right. That's what I figured was going to happen.
Within days, this young man lost his mind completely and plunged a knife into the chest of another boy and killed him.
Now, is it? I've heard that the drugs work in a way that they shut off our brain's inhibitions and our ability to empathize with other people's pain and misery. So that's how you end up with things like people drowning their own children and then committing a murder homicide because they're ending up on their roof trying to cut themselves into pieces and light themselves on fire. You know, we read these stories and it's just completely gruesome and insane. But you know, just 2 weeks ago, this was someone who was mildly depressed or dealing with something. Is that correct in that it shuts off our brain's ability to connect empathy and pain?
Well, that is the first thing that all psychoactive substances do.
Mm-hmm.
Because the highest centers, the most refined aspect of ourselves as human beings, is our social abilities.
Mm-hmm.
You think about, we have these huge frontal lobes that no other animals have.
Right.
They fill up the front of our brain. They developed before there was any technology in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They developed 100,000 years ago. That's before we even have any reported cave drawings. We were just a social tribal creature. And what made us so unique and has allowed us to gain all this power is this social relationships that we develop so we can share knowledge and share growth and development of various kinds. And that is what makes us what we are. And all of these drugs, all psychoactive substances, end up impairing this most delicate, sensitive, subtle part of ourselves, the frontal lobes, which is really, really what's required for the expression of our spiritual nature and our finest and some of our worst attributes. So yes, one of the first things that happens with all psychoactive substances is that the edge, at least the edge, is taken off of our humanity, our caring, our empathy, our sensitivity. And very often, a spouse will notice it. You know, I'll see a couple, and the husband will say that the Prozac has made him feel better, and so on and so forth, and he's saying this in a flat tone of voice, and then his wife says, well, you know, but you've stopped showing any interest in me, or even the children. You don't even pet the dog as much as you used to. Literally, don't pet the dog like you used to.
Mm-hmm.
And other people will see it, but the individual won't. And that's this menace of spellbinding, which I discuss in my book, Medication Madness. Medication Madness, it takes the edge off of the human being, and in the extreme ends up with these violent and destructive episodes.
You say that in Medication Madness, that it masks your underlying psychological problems, and you think you're getting better when, in fact, you're getting worse.
Exactly, that's right. And it accounts for these millions and millions of people on these drugs, because most of these people are not going to tell you that they're living better than ever, that they got over their depression and they actually found they were depressed because they weren't doing the kind of work they wanted to do,
mm-hmm.
so now they're doing better work, or they've learned to be more loving with their husband or wife or their children, or
right.
they've taken on new challenges. It's always a more fitting into where you've been. Unless it's made you manic, in which case you've left your wife and your children, you're not paying child support, and you're running around in some other place. You know?
Right. Now, I have a question about the definitions because on the show we try to define things in the proper lens so that we can understand really what we're talking about. My son goes to Greenwich High School, and they had a forced showing of this somewhat semi documentary called More Than Sad, and he came home and told me all about it. And in the movie, they're pushing drugs. You know, they say that the answer to all these problems of depression, you know, that normal teenagers go through, just be by the rushes of hormones or poor sleep habits, or many different variety of things. But they define depression as an illness. Now, I mean, that to me, that sounds like it's something that you can catch like a virus, whereas I always thought depression was a symptom of an underlying problem. Could you help to define what depression is?
Well, first of all, the whole idea that emotional suffering is a disease is a fabrication of psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry. Remember that psychiatrists are medical doctors. So for 200 or 300 years that we've been in business, we've tried to convince ourselves and everybody else that all the stuff we deal with is genetic and biological. If you go back to Benjamin Rush, who was in some ways a great man, he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, but he was a psychiatrist, which makes him a fool in a lot of ways. But what he's trying to do is make believe that psychological and spiritual things are physical. So he claimed that he could see in cases of mental illness inflammation of the brain, and he saw it on autopsies, and it was inflammation of the brain that caused mental problems. So we've been doing this since time began without evidence. And there's no more evidence for inflammation of the brain than there is for the current biochemical imbalance theory, which no sensible scientist could possibly believe in because there's no evidence for it. And because we've only identified or studied a handful of the 200 neurotransmitters in the brain to begin with, we have hardly any idea what goes on in the brain. So we don't know anything like that. So all of that is a selling campaign to convince people to take drugs. Yet it doesn't make sense necessarily. Even if you had a biochemical imbalance in your brain, what makes you think that a toxic drug is going to correct it? It's a wild shot in the dark.
But if you do have biological imbalances or hormonal imbalances, shouldn't we first look at perhaps maybe our lifestyles, lack of exercise, hormone-inducing chemicals in our food, maybe some chemicals that you're putting on your body through poor quality, say things like skincare products or things like that? We don't even try to consider our environmental toxins before we just go right to the source and say, well, let's just take a drug and it's going to cut off my our selective serotonins, so that, which is SSRI is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So we're just going to block hormones and think that that's going to fix things.
Yes. Well, let's take the analogy a little further. We are concerned about tiny fractions of molecules offending the universe, causing holes in the ozone, minuscule amounts of pesticides causing problems with the eggs and the development of birds. But the pollution we put in the far more sensitive human brain, is the most sensitive corner of the universe, the far, far more sensitive brain, we pollute it with high intensities of toxins and don't even give it second thought. In fact, we're worried now about the environment because of all the Prozac and psychiatric drugs getting flushed into the water.
Right.
There's concern about the fish and abnormalities in fish from medications, including psychiatric drugs, in the lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we're pouring it in, million times higher concentrations into our brains. It's a bizarre idea, and it's now resulting in huge numbers of chronically disabled human beings. The rolls on disability are swelled with these people. And recently, I have a recent scientific article I published, you can find it on my website, called Chronic Brain Impairment. This phenomena I'm describing, where people develop chronic brain impairment, where they're less lively, more apathetic than they used to be. Their emotions are not as regulated or as under their control as they used to be. They get irritable. their memory, what we call cognitive functions, learning isn't quite what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of it, they don't have an awareness of what's happening to them, and that's the medication spellbinding part of the problem. And we have millions and millions of people in this condition now. It's a drastic public health problem.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN, and we're speaking with psychiatrist and author Peter Bragan about the effect of psychiatric drugs. Are they doing more harm than good? And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And if you'd rather email us, you can drop us an email at ken@mdrtalk.org, and we'll read your question or your comment on the air. So that's 203-336-9756 to discuss psychiatric medicines with Dr. Peter Bragan.
Dr. Bragan, I was speaking to a counselor, a therapy student recently. Good, Marge, screen the call. We were talking about psychiatric drugs. I was talking about a family member of mine who had an issue, and he was saying, "Well, I think she really needs to go on one of those antidepressants. It'll really help." And we had a whole conversation about, this is clearly what is taught in the mainstream. But my question is, are these drugs effective at helping a patient open up to be able to deal with an underlying issue, or do they become more of a crutch for the patient to rely on, thinking that the pill is helping them get better rather than actually dealing with what's causing their depression?
Well, the implications of your question are entirely right. I'd go a step further, though. We can't even prove, for example, that antidepressants help people.
Mm-hmm. They're equally as effective as the sugar pills, aren't they?
As the sugar pills. I mean, it's getting to be so well known now that ABC did a show on it. I first talked about it in 1994 and talking back to Prozac. But, see, the FDA requires that a drug company produce two studies showing effectiveness of a drug. But the drug company can do six or seven studies to get the two.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you can't do six or seven studies that you yourself arrange,
mm-hmm.
that you choose the doctors for because you know them well and they've been helping you for years, and where you get to totally evaluate the results, the doctors don't even see the results, you, the company, evaluate the results,
mm-hmm.
you can't produce a couple of studies, to show that a drug helps. You don't know what you're doing.
That's such an important point, Dr. Bragan. I don't think most Americans understand that that's how drugs get on the market.
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with, Monsanto and the GMOs. They rigged the study or any kind of alternative medicine treatment.
Well, the studies are so short. I mean, the Prozac studies were 4 to 6 weeks. A lot of them couldn't reach 6 weeks because
too
many patients dropped out because of adverse effects.
And so they just don't include them, I'm sure.
Yeah, they don't include them, or they reevaluate them as if people finished. They've got all these techniques they do.
But I think we have a call for you, Dr. Bragan.
Go to your doctor, and he tells you to take these drugs for the rest of your life on the basis of a flawed 6-week study.
Right. Mr. Bragan, we have a call for you, March.
Yes, this is Sarah Gregory from New Haven, Connecticut. Go ahead, Sarah. You're on the air with WPKN.
Okay, thank you. I've been listening to your show. I personally just disagree with everything you say. I know, except for the fact that perhaps there are many people misdiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I believe it's true, but you've left out the small population, perhaps. Perhaps you call this the spellbinding effect, where one doesn't rise, but I was depressed and suicidal with evidence for 10 years, and I'm finally taking pharmaceuticals, and they are saving my life, and I am not trying to murder anybody. I'm simply not.
All right, well,
Sarah, thank you very much for taking time to call.
Mm, I'm not really sure how to respond.
Dr. Bragan, do you have any comments on Sarah's call?
No, she sounds very distressed, and I'm sorry for that. That's about all I know.
Dr. Bragan, we talked about the... Do we have another call there, Marshawn?
Go ahead, screen it.
Just one question. We talked about the possible, the biochemical causes of depression, whether that's valid or not. Is there a biological cause for the treatment of children for ADHD? I mean, is there an actual condition there?
Well, there couldn't be, because if you look at the list of ADHD symptoms, that's just a list of things that annoy teachers and require their attention. How can that be a disease?
So this notion that there's some abnormality in the frontal lobe of the child's brain.
This is what I'm saying. Yeah. This is what I'm saying. If you look at what the list of behaviors is, there's three groups. Impulsivity is interrupting the teacher. That's what it says in the diagnostic manual. Interrupting the teacher before she's finished her question to give the answer.
Right, so the whole idea is to just hammer everybody into a shaped hole, you know, taking a square peg and ramming it into a round hole because you don't fit the profile of a public school student.
Well, that's the result of it, but the actual goal is simpler. It's to get teachers to push drugs for the kids by taking every behavior that could possibly bother them.
Mm-hmm. And the teachers don't realize that they're doing this, though, of course.
Squirming in your seat. Getting up out of your seat. This is what's in the manual.
But the teachers don't realize that they've become, de facto drug pushers. They don't realize this.
No, they've been duped. Because,
right.
You see, the drugs for a few weeks before the brain fights back, the drugs crush spontaneity, all of the stimulant drugs,
right.
And increase obsessive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You do it in monkeys, chimpanzees. It's got nothing to do with the disease. It's just none of these drugs have no psychiatric drug has specificity for a disorder. They're all just agents that disrupt normal brain function. And the way that stimulants disrupt normal brain function is they suppress spontaneity and they push obsessiveness. In any animal
right.
or any child,
right.
It makes a chimp look like he's happy in his cage because he's sitting still instead of trying to get out, and it makes a kid look like a better student because he's sitting still.
When really they just become a zombie.
Zombie effect. And in fact, in the extreme, the scientific literature mentions the zombie effect, but that's just the extreme of what it's causing in all the children. Now, there's no disorder there. You could be jumping around in class because the teacher's boring, because you haven't learned to eat, because there's a divorce in your family, you got bullied on the school bus, you're hungry and you're eating junk food.
Yes.
I mean, it's infinite numbers of reasons somebody would be hyperactive or impulsive. But one of the just to show you how evil these people are, when they found that based on these criteria, they were drugging 90% of the boys, 90% of the people being drugged were boys, and they figured, how are we going to get the girls' market? So they added the third leg, which is inattention. So now the daydreaming girl, who's mm-hmm. the opposite of a hyperactive boy,
mm-hmm.
also gets
She's also sick. Dr. Bregan, I think we have a phone call for you.
We do. This kind of sounds similar to the Brits pushing opium on the Chinese, but we have Mark from New Haven. Go ahead, Mark. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hey, Doc. How you doing? I was diagnosed. Well, I took, medication madness. I got out of divorce. I got a little depressed. Doctor prescribed Wellbutrin to me. After the seventh day, I had a seizure from the medication. And then ever since then, I've had seizures. So now they have me on Keppra. So then I go for a third opinion. The doctor meets me for 1 hour, and then he wants to prescribe another medication for me. You know, now he wants me to take two medications. And I just feel, how can you diagnose somebody, meeting them for not even a half hour, and then throw them on another medication? I mean, it's bizarre.
Dr. Bregan?
Wellbutrin's a very stimulating antidepressant, and it does cause seizures. It causes seizures. I haven't heard often of the seizures recurring after the drug is stopped. So you've had recurrent seizures after stopping the drug, sir?
I don't think Mark's on the air anymore,
Dr. Bregan. We were getting an echo. We had to drop the call.
Okay, he's jumped off.
Yeah, thanks for calling,
it sounded
Mark.
Like he was, though.
Seizures are a genuine neurologic problem, in this case caused by the Wellbutrin. I would shop around until you find a neurologist, if you're still having seizures, who will spend the time you want and give you the attention you want. You may need a medication to help you control seizures. But again, it's unusual for them to persist after the Wellbutrin is stopped. and I would get yourself the best possible neurological evaluation you can get. It should include brain scan. It should include a EEG. So just get yourself a good workup and get the best neurologist you can find to talk to you about what's going on.
And we actually...
Mark is back on the line.
Yeah, Mark, so. You're back with us. So yeah. Did you hear the doctor's response?
Yeah. I just, you know, he says I was in a bad motorcycle 25 years ago and I have scar tissue.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Is the doc on or no?
Yes, the doctor's with you.
Yeah, I'm on. Well, you know, that's possible. And then you take the Wellbutrin... And it just overstimulates some irritable tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to take very good care of yourself. Stay away as much as you can. Stay away from psychiatric drugs and all antidepressants and all stimulants.
Are these drugs that he's able to just stop cold turkey, or does he have to cycle off of them?
Well, you're not on them, are you? You're not on any.
I'm on Keppra now.
Yeah. You just need to talk to your neurologist about what kind of medication is going to help you the best. And
you know, he says I'm on Keppra now, and he wants me to get something else because of my mood swing, because the Keppra is making me, you know, anxiety. My mind doesn't feel like it's stopping, and mm-hmm. I'm not myself.
Yeah. Well, why don't you suggest to him that instead of adding a second medication, you try to either adjust the lower the dose or find another primary medication, rather than putting on a medication for mood swings.
And doctor, you wouldn't recommend getting off the drugs and adjusting his lifestyle to try to maybe reintroduce new focus in
his
life?
I'm a clean and sober recovering addict for 25 years,
uh-huh.
and I don't want to take any drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm on this stuff.
Are you still having seizures, though?
I had a seizure about 5 months ago. And I had lowered my dose to one pill instead of two.
I would get off.
Was it a full seizure?
It was it was in my sleep.
You don't know what it is. I'm not going to tell you to just get off the medication for the seizures.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to suggest that you really work hard, try with a neurologist, see if another medication that isn't...
the one that he told me was an RX,
I'm not
like
sure
a time release, that would help also my mood swings, you know?
A time release tablet, he said, doctor?
Of what?
I forgot the name of it, but it also
helped you there. But see, we're getting into the fine-tuning of what's potentially a medical, not a psychiatric problem.
Okay.
Don't get into treating mood swings because a drug is giving you mood swings.
Yeah,
try to find a drug that will help
you. I'll do my exercise. I'm a big cyclist.
Yeah.
I listen to, you know, I cycle. I eat pretty good. The only thing I do is I smoke cigars. Yeah. You know?
How do you know you had a seizure if it was in your sleep?
Well, when I woke up, I must have hit my head, too. I have, like, a nice coat rack.
Okay.
So when I woke up, I had a big hole in my forehead, and I needed like 7 stitches. And
Well, you see, the danger of seizures, and that's why I wouldn't just stop your medication.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But find somebody you can really work with. There are many drugs.
You meet a doctor for less than a half hour, and he doesn't even know me, and that's where I get frustrated. And then here he is. Oh, get this. If you don't get a rash, start this. So now he wants me to be on 2 medications.
All right, well, caller, we thank you very much for the help.
Thanks a lot,
Mark. We
have
to move along and shift gears here. But I think the key is to find a doctor you feel comfortable with who actually listens to what you have to say and spend enough time with you, right?
Dr. Bregan, it sounds like Mark may have had some serious medical problem, but in your book, which are really case studies of your own patients, some of these people seemed like to me that they were suffering from a depression that was not that serious, like a Harry Henderson, if you recall that case you write about. Could you talk about his case? The businessman who went try to steal a shotgun?
Yeah, I mean, he was... it's the opening case in the book, and
mm-hmm.
he like so many people, he went to the doctor with a medical problem. He picks up a pamphlet about Paxil helping with depression, and he doesn't realize it's an advertisement. You know, he thinks it's educational materials, and which it masquerades as. And he asks what was actually in the real case. And I think it would be this way in the book too, because I tried to really stick close to the absolutely to the cases in the book. He goes, and it's a physician's assistant, and the physician's assistant says, "Yeah, here's a medication for you." And the Paxil made him so crazy that he's a very kind man. He's a religious man, a spiritual man. In fact, this is such a nice man that when I went to his community to interview people about him to do a report for the court on him, there were so many people who wanted to say how wonderful he was that I had to meet with a whole group in a kitchen and not just do individual sessions, which I also did.
Mm-hmm.
And he got so whacked out that he felt he had to absolutely kill himself. The inner pain was overwhelming. People get this horrible, indescribable inner pain at times from these medications. Sometimes it's associated with an agitation that makes you want to move about. Then it's called technically akathisia, the inability to sit still. And he was so unsophisticated that he didn't even know how to buy a gun, so he wasn't able to get himself a gun. He thought about killing himself and his wife because he didn't want to leave her behind.
Mm-hmm.
Just weird thoughts that people get. And so he thought, well, I'll go down to the police station. I've seen the guns standing up in the cars in the police stations. He didn't even know what they were, shotguns. You know, he didn't know whether they were shotguns, rifles. He didn't know how to cock a gun. He didn't know anything about guns. But on his way down, he saw a policeman giving a ticket to somebody. So he parked behind the cop, and when the policeman was exposed, he ran him over.
Wow.
That hurt him very, very badly, but kept me screaming, I don't want to hurt you. I just need this gun to kill myself. And he was subdued by the injured policeman and by a passerby. And when I got through writing this really detailed scientific report about what had happened to him, even the policeman didn't want to press charges, and he ended up not spending much time at all in jail.
Wow.
Well, it's fortunate.
It's really unfortunate. I mean, and
listen, I want to finish about this.
Okay.
This is not a case where the guy then says, wow, look at me, I got free on a Prozac excuse. This man did not recover emotionally in the lengthy time I knew him. He was so filled with remorse that he would ever do anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
So he not only ruined or injured the life of another person, and his family, of course, but the injury to himself. I mean, he didn't cheer that he'd gotten off from this.
No, of course not. He didn't mean to do it. This shows that also the dangers of advertising directly to the public these potentially dangerous drugs. Have you heard of the website SSRIstories.com?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, for the listening audience, it's a searchable database of 4,800-plus news stories about violent adverse reactions to antidepressant medications. In that database, I was looking at it to prepare for the show, it has a list of over 80 acts of violence, like assault with a weapon, suicide, homicide, all taking place in and around schools. And we hear about school shootings or acts of violence around schools, but we never hear later on the news that the shooter was on antidepressants. It just says, just like last week, someone was apprehended outside Cleveland, recently.
I'm wondering about this soldier, you know, who just killed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. 89% of soldiers with PTSD are on SSRI antidepressants, and the suicide rate and violence among veterans is skyrocketing.
Actually, Dr. Breggett testified about that before Congress. I saw your YouTube interview. I mean, I saw it on YouTube. Are there not many soldiers who are taking psychiatric drugs, Dr. Breggett?
Well, yeah. Actually, the war in Iraq was the first time we ever allowed soldiers in combat on psychiatric drugs.
Wow.
Now I have cases coming to me where soldiers aren't allowed to go in combat without their psychiatric drugs.
Mm-hmm.
A soldier can be sent off with a 180-day supply of addictive psychiatric drugs, antipsychotic drugs, specifically Seroquel, for 180 days in his pocket, going to combat. Nobody's supervising them. They're young men and women. They end up trading drugs, taking, you know, large amounts, you know, after they've been through something stressful.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be at all surprised if that shooter, and I'd love to get somebody to let me know about it, was on psychiatric drugs.
Yeah, it might be too soon to find out, but like we know Major Hassan down in the Texas shooting 2 years ago, he was a psychiatrist in the Army. He was self-medicating on antidepressants.
How about Columbine?
Columbine, Eric Harris.
You mentioned Eric Harris in Medication Madness. He was taking drugs?
I just got loud.
Yeah, the newspapers lie about it.
He was taking what? Luvox, right?
He was taking Luvox, which is an SSRI antidepressant. And he'd started on another one and ended up on that. And we know as a fact that he had, quote, and this is so ironic, a therapeutic level in his blood on autopsy.
Therapeutic.
Which means that he took the drug very recently, probably on that day or the day before. And USA Today comes out with a story last year revisiting it and says, we now know that Eric Harris wasn't taking psychiatric drugs. Well, I sent them a letter, cited the FDA report, gave him the URL to find it, offered to send it to him, proving he was on psychiatric drugs, and they ignored me.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned how much soldiers are being medicated and the violent reactions, because the Army Times, not that long ago, it was maybe 6 months ago or so, had a really interesting article about the relationship between soldiers being overly medicated and violent acts, because there was a really bad incident, I guess maybe it was about a year or so ago, where a soldier lost his mind and shot his platoon sergeant, his battle buddy, and several other soldiers on his FOB for no properly explainable reason. The witnesses had said he had suffered from depression, but he hadn't given a whole lot of signs, and just one day he just snapped, and it hadn't been like he was in any particularly harsh combat that caused him to snap.
Or this happens all the time. What about the 19-year-old who killed his buddy, who was trying to keep him from jumping out the window? He was trying to jump out the window to kill himself. His platoon mate came over to rescue him. He killed the guy who tried to rescue him.
Exactly.
Maybe this is too obvious a question, but Dr. Regan, how has this been kept out of the news so well? This is such a huge story.
The drug companies have enormous power. They have the psychiatric drug company, what I call the psychopharmaceutical complex, is by far and away the most powerful lobby in Congress. They spend a lot of money educating journalists, educating judges. They exert a lot of power through advertising.
The biggest advertisers are network news. You can watch any news show, and 3 out of the 5 advertisements are going to be for a drug in any commercial break.
And, of course, the psychiatric journals are totally dependent on the psychiatric drugs. It was better, actually, in the early 1990s when I wrote Toxic Psychiatry. I wrote Talking Back to Prozac. You could get tons of newspaper stories where violence was associated with an antidepressant. It was one of the things that I used as evidence, you know, for what we now know for sure.
Is that before they were allowed to directly market?
It was before the drug companies clamped down on the journalists.
When did we start allowing direct marketing to consumers?
You know, I don't know. It's fairly recent. I don't know, 10 years or so?
Yeah, I thought it was like 96 or something.
It's fairly recent. I think only us in New Zealand allow it.
That's
I'm ambivalent about that because I do believe in free speech and I have libertarian tendencies. I think the real issue is the failure to tell the truth about the drugs. Because if the truth were being told, nobody'd take most of these drugs.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context. We're talking with psychiatrist Dr. Peter Bregan about the effects of psychiatric medications. And if you want to join the conversation, we only have about 8 minutes left in our program. Give us a ring at 203-336-9756.
I'd like to tell your audience about our upcoming conference.
Sure.
By
all means.
We have a conference that it's called the Empathic Therapy Conference. It has two parts to it. One, the better ways of helping people, and the other is the critiques that I'm giving you today on psychiatry. In fact, we have a panel of lawyers and survivors talking about horrible SSRI crimes and violence, including a woman whose husband killed their children. So we have the mix of the better approaches and the issues of how bad the drugs and shock treatment really are for people. The conference is April 13th through 15th, just a month away, in Syracuse, New York. Our last one was considered by many people the best conference they ever attended. Mm-hmm. This will be even better.
And where can they get more information, the details, on your website?
Yeah, well, you can go to two places. Go to Bregan.com, and you'll see information. You'll have to look around for it, Bregan.com, but also empathictherapy.org. That's the website for our organization.
Empathic therapy.
Empathictherapy.org.
Empathy,
like empathictherapy.org. Or go to Bregan.com.
I think we have one more phone call.
We have one more caller. It's Mike from Bridgeport. Go ahead, Mike. You are on the air with WPKN.
Hello. Years ago, I worked at Fairfield Hills Psychiatric Hospital in Newtown.
Mm-hmm.
And I was researching case files for the Coordinated Services Project at the time.
Let's get Mike, can you just speak up a little bit?
Okay. And I was researching case files. That was my primary responsibility for 6 months. And during that time, I noticed that the given time for patient assessment and diagnosis with a new patient was 15 minutes, whereupon they would be medicated.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Mm-hmm. 15 minutes.
That was pretty much standard. I've also since noticed, while going through a disability process with the Veterans Administration at three different institutions in the state of Connecticut, federal and state level, that their time is also about 15 minutes.
It seems impossible to me to really find out what's causing the person's depression, whether it is, as they would say, a hormonal imbalance, or if it's just because the person spends a lot of time indoors playing video games without actually exerting energy for exercise purposes and a good diet.
Does this surprise you, what Mike said, Dr. Bregan?
Oh, no. It doesn't surprise me at all. A lot of it's governed by a payment system that,
profitability.
That compensates for 15 minutes. Many psychiatrists in private practice, they shave it down to 10 minutes. They can see six patients in an hour. They make six times more than they could as a therapist. But psychiatrists also aren't looking to understand the human being because, frankly, if you cared about human beings and you got to know them, you understood what was happening with them, you would never give them drugs. You'd give them emotional support, encouragement, some guidance. Maybe you'd want to meet with the family, help the family improve its relationships. If you're allowing yourself to be a caring human being, you're just not going to give drugs. So psychiatrists shut themselves off. They have tunnel vision. They actually think the DSM has some truth in it. They use the diagnoses and they give their drugs, and then when one drug doesn't work, maybe two will, maybe three will, maybe six will. It's a thoughtless process that's lacking in humanity, and it's what modern psychiatry has become.
Mm-hmm. I noticed in the case of one case that came to concern me because I personally knew the individual, that she had seen seven psychiatrists and had received seven different diagnoses and several different medications.
That's key.
For each diagnosis. And eventually the last one, we had to have him call a judge in chambers because he couldn't possibly have indicated in any other way that he believed this individual was actually best described as a political prisoner.
That's interesting. Mike, we thank you very much for the
call. My question was...
Well, we need to jump because we have one last call, but can you do it quickly? Can you say...
Yes, it is.
Go ahead.
My question ultimately, since we're losing... A lot of us are losing in the VA system. We're losing our confidence in psychiatrists.
Mm-hmm.
We're losing our confidence in physicians. And in particular in medication.
Yes.
And are increasingly beginning to self-medicate, but trying to find something safe. What is your opinion for major dysfunctional symptomology like depression, anxiety, pain, on pot?
The answer is not in safer drugs. All psychoactive substances disable the brain. There is no psychoactive substance that improves this incredible aspect of ourselves called our brain. And none of these things are physical in origin, and if they were, we haven't figured it out. And what people need is healthy living. They need a good spiritual outlook on life.
Mm-hmm.
If they're deeply troubled, some really good counseling would help. Often, I think family therapy helps because You want the family to be able to help itself eventually without the therapist, but the answer isn't in tinkering with the brain.
That's right. Well, Mike, we thank you very much for the call. We want to jump to one last
We have time for one last phone call. Caller?
Whoops, got to turn on my mic again. This is Victoria from New Haven. Go ahead, Victoria.
Hi, Victoria. You're
on the air with WPK.
Hi. I wanted to say, first of all, thank you for this amazing program.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I am, and it's always amazing. I am a consumer in the mental health system. I am fortunate to be surrounded by the love of family and friends. I'm currently doing it drug-free, having been very negatively impacted by some of the meds I've been on, including SSRIs. Mm-hmm. But I just thought that this would be a great time to quote Patch Adams, a noted physician, author, and performer. He says, "I have never disliked any of my patients so much that I have prescribed for them psychiatric."
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I like what Pat says.
Thank you, Victoria.
It reminds me of a debate I was having with a pediatrician. And he said, "Well, doc, you know, I agree with you basically, but two or three of my children every year need drugs." And I looked at him and I said, "Doc, I don't know how you pick which one to poison."
Wow. March, you said we have an email?
Yeah, it's kind of a long one.
Can you summarize it? Well, go ahead and read the comment, and then we're going to have to sign off.
Okay. This is from Andrew S. Ross in Norwalk. He said, "My ex-wife and her family law attorney accused me of being bipolar and forced me to a psychopharmacologist before I could see him. I resisted and went, and a neurologist put me on Wellbutrin. Mm-hmm. When I went to the CVS to get the prescription filled, the clerk told me that it would negatively affect the five medications I was taking for my heart condition, arterial fibrillation. The Wellbutrin could have hurt my serious heart condition. So the CVS employee was smarter than the GW neurologist and neurology professor."
Wow. I mean, that's similar. Ken, remember that story you were telling me on the way up here about the person who had a skin problem? He couldn't eat cabbage because it would negatively impact his medication. So they're actually giving us medication.
Can't eat vegetables.
You can't even eat vegetables, which are good for your health and your mental state of being. And we're out of time. We need to sign off. But Dr. Breggin, you want to plug your website one more time?
Well, it's breggin.com. And empathictherapy.org. Come to an amazing conference with 30 presenters full of life and love who don't buy the psychiatric line and will offer you better things. April 13th through 15th.
Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Breggin. We've been talking to Dr. Peter Breggin about the effects of psychiatric drugs.
Remember to find us on YouTube, youtube.com, and then search In Context Report. You can find all of our new recent interviews in there. And next week, we're going to be playing our last interview that we did with Michael Murphy, director of the new movie, Why in the World Are They Spraying? We're going to be playing that next Monday. It's a 15-minute interview, and then we're going to have a conversation after that. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/InContextReport. The website is InContextReport.com.
And stay tuned for Rick Patrone. He's coming up next.
See ya.
Take it easy.
Bye.
If everybody's wrong, young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop.